Up next, former SNL writer and Thurber Prize winner Ellen Zweibel. His new collection of stories and essays, Clothing Optional, finds the humor in awkward moments at a nudist resort, being beaten in a marathon by a polar bear, and confrontations with fans. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from Aquila Theater, presenting Joseph Heller's Catch-22, the story of Yusarian, a World War II B-25 bombardier who wants to live forever, November 14th through December 20th at Lucille Ortel Theater. More at AquilaTheater.com. Liberty Science Center, presenting their newest exhibition, The Science of Survival, now through February 22nd at Liberty State Park in Jersey City. Details and tickets at lsc.org. Greenwich Letterpress, purveyors of fine paper goods, modern handmade gifts, and artisanal letterpress printing, located in Greenwich Village at 39 Christopher Street and online at greenwichletterpress.com. Center in Teaneck, New Jersey, equipped with advanced technology and designed to reduce waiting times, more at 877-HOLY-NAME. WNYC gratefully acknowledges the backing of our corporate underwriters and would like to add your business to our diverse list of supporters. To become a WNYC underwriter, contact Executive Director Vincent Gardino at 646-829-4477.
Merkin Concert Hall supports WNYC and presents the New York Woodwind Quartet and pianist Ursula Oppens in a tribute to Elliot Carter, Sunday, November 23rd at 8. More information, kaufman-center.org. WNYC is giving away one pair of tickets for Sunday to the third caller to reach us at 212-433-9692. But please note, if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days, you're not eligible for these tickets. Ellen Zweibel began to earn a living by making people laugh when he wrote one-liners for Borscht Belt comedians. In the 1970s, he became one of the original writers for Saturday Night Live, and since then he's received numerous Emmys and Writers Guild Awards for his work on shows like Gary Shandling and Curb Your Enthusiasm. He earned the prestigious Thurber Prize for comedy writing in 2006 for his novel, The Other Shulman. And now Ellen Zweibel has a second book out, a collection of short pieces called Clothing Optional and Other Ways to Read These Stories, published by Villard Books. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to the show. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm okay. What do you mean by that title? How many ways are there to read these stories?
You know something? It's a collection of the short stories and essays, and the Villard, the editors there said, you know, Clothing Optional is in fact an essay. It's the title of one of the essays there.
You were sent to a nudist colony.
I was sent to a nudist colony for a weekend and to write about my exploits. And they said, gee, you know, you need a subtitle of some sort. So came up with about 50 of them, and I'm not quite sure what "in other ways to read these stories" actually means, but it was the best of all of them. So we said, okay, let's use that one.
Well, it kind of tells us that it's funny. You don't hear much about nudist colonies anymore. Are there a lot of nudist colonies in the United States still?
Well, this one was in Palm Springs, California.
Oh, so at least it was warm.
It was incredibly warm. And they have a lot of them. Apparently, I only became aware of them after I spent this weekend there. And it was 18 naked couples and me. Okay. I went out there, and the first thing I did before I went out there was I packed. I brought luggage to a nudist camp. And it was a very, very interesting experience. At first, I was very skittish about the whole thing. But after a little while, you go, oh, what the hell? And you got with it, you know.
In your foreword, you write as Mrs. Pearl Blankman, your high school English teacher, who's shocked by your success as a writer, considering the fact that when you were her student, you were a veritable illiterate. Are you surprised as much by your career as you imagine Mrs. Blankman would be?
You know, I'm surprised only because I always wanted to do this. And do dreams come true? In this particular case, I guess so. And I'm delighted. Growing up, I used to watch the old Dick Van Dyke Show, and I went, gee, I'd like to do that. This guy seems like he's having a good time. He was married to Mary Tyler Moore, had a nice house in New Rochelle, a kid, and spent his days lying on a couch joking around with Buddy and Sally. I said, that looks like a nice way to make a living. And the fact that it's happened, and I've had the opportunity to do some other things probably because of the great break that I got from Saturday Night Live opened up a lot of doors to me. I'm just having a really good time. So I've written children's books. I co-wrote 700 Sundays, Billy Crystal's Tony Award-winning show. So it's given me a lot of opportunities.
And it's always about writing funny? Did you write funny when you were in high school?
Yeah, I tried, and I failed. I failed being funny. I failed the classes because they were supposed to be poems, and they were supposed to be, okay, describe the tree, that kind of stuff. And I just couldn't take it seriously.
Well, most of the people with your kind of background wound up doing stand-up, but you didn't. You wrote for other comedians.
I wrote for other comedians when I first started. They paid me $7 a joke. These were guys who were working the Catskill Mountains. I was just out of college. I was 21.
But it must have been good training.
It was very good training. What I did, I learned how to write jokes, okay, which when I ultimately auditioned for Lorne Michaels, I put together a whole book of all my jokes that I had written for others. And he went through the book and saw that I could write jokes. And so he gave me a job on this new show called Saturday Night Live because I guess he liked my sense of humor. Plus, there was going to be Weekend Update, which was very joke-driven.
Because there's a big difference between writing jokes, writing skits, writing plays, and writing short stories, and then writing novels.
It's different muscles that you're flexing. And the joke... Yeah, joke writing is its own little art form where in 10, 12, 15 words, there's a laugh at the end. So there's a rhythm there that, while not predictable, you have to follow, you have to have an instinct for it. I don't really subscribe to the notion that you can teach somebody how to be funny. Yeah, you can hone your craft, but the fact that I've been able to do these different things... once again, I've had the opportunity where I can roam around a little bit.
But when you're writing for something like Curb Your Enthusiasm, you're not writing jokes per se. You're writing funny situations, aren't you?
Absolutely.
And you're relying on somebody else's delivery to make it fun.
Television, and in particular a show like Curb Your Enthusiasm, is very collaborative. But TV is done very much in groups, tables where there are seven or eight funny people looking at a script, trying to make it funny, everybody throwing in ideas. On Curb Your Enthusiasm, as it was with Saturday Night Live to a great extent, the writer and the actor gets together and creates a situation. And if you got great improv actors, they write for you and you follow their leads.
Now, what were the circumstances for the pieces in this book? Some of them are normal size, but some of them are very, very short. When we say short story, we're talking short story. You write many of the things in Clothing Optional actually happened. So I'm assuming many of the things didn't happen.
There are some things that are totally made up. There are some things that are based on truths that they exaggerated. There's a piece in there called Mrs. Glickman's Deposition. In real life, what had happened was an 84-year-old woman hit my car broadside. And the insurance companies couldn't come to any sort of settlement. So she sued me personally. Her husband did. She was 84. He was 87. He sued me personally for something that's called loss of consortium, which meant she couldn't satisfy him sexually, this 84-year-old woman.
But she
woman.
Hit you, broadside.
She hit me, okay? But she claimed that because of the accident, she said that it was my fault, okay, that I was in the middle of an intersection. The point being that an 87-year-old man sued me because his 84-year-old wife can no longer satisfy him sexually. Well, this to me was insane. So there was a deposition. There were lawyers.
This is a sexist remark on your part. You know that.
Well, how so?
When to your 84.
No. I'm not talking about her abilities. She now had a broken hip, so she couldn't do what she did to him before.
Yeah, I understand.
So it was more about the guy, this 87-year-old bag of bones that was sitting in the corner of this deposition. You go, he wants these things from her? This is what he demands in bed, and she can't do this anymore? So it became more of that. I took that as a germ, and I embellished on it.
The question of fame comes up a couple of times over the course of the book. Have you found yourself jealous of some of the actors that you've written for who have become quite famous?
No. There are writers that are secretly jealous. There is a part of the writer that goes, well, wait a second. he's famous or he got a laugh because I wrote that, and mm-hmm. he's taken the bow and the acknowledgement.
People think Gary Shandling is so funny. Well, he wouldn't be funny if I didn't give him those lines.
Well, there's a small part. It depends on the writer and the writer's ego, how much of that, how big that part is. With myself, I've been fortunate enough where I know my role. I'm happy that I'm able to furnish other people with material. And the fact that I have been writing books and doing some other things that get me on the David Letterman show or your show, so I satisfy that urge just as well, you know.
And in the story, Letters from an Annoying Man, you present the downside of being well-known.
Well,
is that based on reality?
Absolutely. A man had written me a letter asking me for an autograph. I sent it to him, the book that I had at the time, The Other Shulman. He sent back the book. He wasn't happy with the inscription. I rewrote it in another book. And before you know it, he became a part of my life. I couldn't shake the guy. And me being a nice guy, kept on answering him. Before you know it, he wanted me to read his novel. He accused me of plagiarizing or stealing from him because I used the word stampede in an op-ed page piece I had for the Times. And he had the word stampede in this 700-page tome that he sent me. And it became nuts, you know, so it just escalated.
My guest is Alan Zweibel, Zweibel. His latest book, Clothing Optional and Other Ways to Read These Stories, which is published by Villard. There's another one on fame called Comic Dialogue, in which somebody codifies fame for you. And it's all about the tier, that there are different tiers of fame.
I took all possibly 100 comedians that I had written for before I got the job on Saturday Night Live. I took all of them, and I basically molded them into one guy. Comic Dialogue, four dialogues that I had with this now fictitious, but this amalgamation, if you will, over a 10-year period of time. And in it, this is probably, I would say, more for stand-up and maybe that ilk of stand-up where they do categorize people who are unknowns, semi-names, names, big names, stars, big stars, mega stars. And I remember when I was writing for a lot of those comedians, they would refer to Engelbert Humperdinck at the time as a megastar, as opposed to Toadie Fields, who was just a star, as opposed to Morty Gunty or Corbett Monica, who were semi-names, as opposed to Dick Lord, who was an unknown. And within that structure, not only did it imply how much, who knew you, but it also how much money you got when you were booked in nightclubs.
You have a rather poignant story about Herb Sargent.
Herb Sargent, when we started Saturday Night Live, to me was this legendary comedy writer. When I was a little boy, I used to run errands for my father, who had his place on 52nd between 5th and Madison. And I used to go by way of what was then the RCA building in Rockefeller Center. NBC was upstairs, and there was a show called That Was the Week That Was. And it was produced.
David Frost.
Buck Henry was on the show, Bob Dishy. And Herb Sargent produced it. And now, many years later, probably 12, 15 years later, I get this job on this new show. And Herb Sargent is white-haired, very good-looking gentleman, who was legendary for not saying too much, okay? Somebody once said the joke of Herb Sargent could talk. Can you imagine the stories that he'd tell? And he and I developed a father-son relationship. I gravitated toward him because he ran Weekend Update. Like I said earlier, jokes were my forte when I first started. And so we started doing a lot of Weekend Update together, and we went out, we went out to dinner, and he became a father figure to me. And as my career, after I left Saturday Night Live and my career progressed and I moved to L.A. and started doing other things, he was the guy I kept in touch with. He was in New York. He held down the fort here in New York while I was out in L.A. And he was of great comfort, and he was a mentor to me. And somewhere along the line, we lost touch.
And then he died.
And we never discussed it. And it's a pang in my heart. And I just hope that somehow he knows that I love them, you know. So that's what that piece was.
I've always wondered about how those jokes get written. I mean, some jokes are obvious. I'm watching Saturday Night Live, the political jokes, or when Jay Leno, David Letterman do them. Some of them seem obvious. They're the kinds of jokes that I make up when I'm watching the news. But then there are the other ones, often much better. And I wonder, is that just somebody is really brilliant at it, just responds so well to the news, or was that often done by committee? You said, hey, how about Barack Obama, blah, blah, blah. And somebody said, no, let's do it this way. And then eventually you come up with something that's really good.
It can be by committee. Somebody could write something. I know oftentimes I've written something, or when I've run TV shows, somebody will write a joke and you go, all right, that's a really funny idea. Can we make it a little bit punchier? And then somebody else will give it a better punchline or just tighten it a little bit. So it can be done that way.
Woody Allen's first wife, if I remember correctly, sued him because he made fun of her during his early stand-up routines. What does your wife, Robin, feel about the stories that you've put in this book?
There's a lot of eye-rolling. You know, this book, these pieces were written over a 25-year period of time. I wrote
most of them published before?
Most of them, I'd say about half were published. I'd say about a quarter were rejected, and they're in there. And I'd say about a quarter of the others are brand new that I wrote specifically for this volume. My wife, just like the wife of any comedian or any writer, recognizes themselves and their lives on the screen or wherever it is it's portrayed. And
in other words, you had a funny thing happen at breakfast, and then she watches Curb Your Enthusiasm, and she says, you just stole our conversation.
Yeah, and you know something? There are some things where you invade a little privacy, and you go, oh, God, I'm sorry. Or otherwise, oh, come on. No one knows that's you. You know? So
and everybody does, actually.
Everyone knows it. You know, nothing flies into when you're doing something domestic, few things fly into your head that you haven't experienced or heard about before. Come on. We all live the same lives, you know.
So, by and large. So she's just learned how to deal with it.
She's rolled with the punches. And like I said, I'm sure there's a lot of talks to her mom that I'm not privy to. You know?
Alan Zweibel, his book is called Clothing Optional and Other Ways to Read These Stories. It's published by Villard. And I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks
today.
So much for having me.
A lot of fun.
Thank you.